Mark 14, starting at verse 26. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus said to them, "You will fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." If you'll remember, just two verses before, Jesus has already predicted. He said, "This is my blood of the covenant. Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And now he just continues to make these prophecies. And it is worth pointing out that all of those prophecies come true within the Gospel of Mark. "I will strike the shepherd," he says, "and the sheep will be scattered." Just as a point of congruence here, remember the oklos, another way to describe them is sheep without a shepherd. The milling crowd, the crowd that needs leadership. "After I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Even though they all fall away, I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night," another prediction, "before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But Peter said emphatically, "If I must die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said the same. The enthusiasm of the crowd, the hypocrisy of the crowd. I suppose in the moment, they all believe it. So this isn't about judging them as liars. When the crowd is cheering for Jesus as the new Messiah coming in to redeem Jerusalem, they aren't lying. They really do believe it in the moment. And then when they cry out for his blood later on, they really do believe it. And here Peter and the disciples believe with all their hearts in their feelings that they will not deny Jesus. And this has nothing to do with the level of emotion. Faith and belief has actually nothing to do with the level of emotion or emphasis that one puts on one's words. And this isn't even a judgment of them. This is just to say, be careful of following after the crowd and its feelings, because the crowd and its feelings are fickle. And here, Peter and the disciples, on the strength of their emphasis and honest feelings, declare something which they will deny in the next few verses. And then they go to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter, James, and John, so the three people he took with him to the Mount of Transfiguration. And Jesus began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And again, more evidence here of Jesus' passion. He's not, if you'll forgive me, you've been with me now for 26 episodes, so you'll forgive me if I say he's not hovering 6 inches above the shit. Jesus, the incarnation of Jesus, is right there in the midst of everything. When we say Jesus was God become flesh, we mean that he cried, he had sweat, he had bad breath, his heart raced when he grew angry, and he gets passionate and greatly troubled by things. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Not my will, but yours be done. There's lots one could say here. It's a very important, what's the best word here? It's like a controlling idea or a dominant mode of thinking, which becomes quite important when the early church is trying to organize itself. They are trying to organize themselves around this principle, not my will, but yours be done. And another way you could describe that, if you were going to work that out in a political sense and you're trying to organize yourself in such a way as it reflects this statement, not my will, but yours be done, you might say something like Ephesians 5:21, "Everyone submit one to another." Or you might say, "Everyone treat others as better than yourselves." Or you might say, "We are one body with many members, and no member is more important than the other." This idea that not my will but yours be done is also connected to the ancient teaching in Philippians 2. Philippians 2 has the oldest passage in the New Testament. So there's a hymn in Philippians 2. And so Paul is writing, he's the first writer we have in the New Testament. And he, in Philippians 2, quotes a hymn or a poem that he himself did not write. So he's putting something into his letter that came from the earliest church. And in that hymn, it says, Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he made himself as nothing and became like a servant. And then at the end of that hymn, he's given all authority and power, and at the feet of Jesus, everything shall bow, and all tongues confess that he is Lord. And the word there, though, is that we're looking at is the one where it says Jesus emptied himself. And it's the word is kenosis. And another way of describing that, it's not becoming a cringing worm or becoming as nothing. It isn't becoming as nothing, which sometimes one finds that in English translations. Even the phrase emptied himself can bring some problems because we think of that as completely removing your sense of self, becoming a subservient doormat. But the word kenosis is not about that. It's more like, imagine if a bathtub is flowing, you're filling a bathtub and the water flows to fill the space quite naturally, right? But now imagine that the water stopped halfway through and it didn't flow to fill the space. It self-empties. In a personal point of view, you think of like a human being, somebody who bursts into a room and their ego flows to fill the room and all eyes have to stop and all conversations cease and they point towards that person. That would be an ego flowing to fill the room. Their will dominates the room. And then what Jesus does is the opposite. He enters a space, but he puts a limit on his will. He self-empties to allow space for other wills. I think I may have talked about this before, but anyway, it comes up here. So when what he's doing is Jesus is saying, here's my will. I'm going to put a limit on my will to make room for other people's will. It's an attitude not of cringing inferiority, but of self-control. It's actually empowering because one has to have a self to control. It's empowering because one has power and realizes one is responsible for his power. So now what do we do about it? And Jesus willingly chooses to lay down his life. He willingly chooses to withdraw or put a limit on what he wants. And this is the fundamental, it's literally probably the oldest and first thing that anybody wrote about Jesus. He didn't consider being a God or being like God something to be grasped and used for his own advantage. Instead, he put a limit on his will to make space for others. Again, King Jesus is not a dominant king. He shows that being a king is not about dominating the room and forcing his will on others, which of course is the exact opposite of what anybody expects a king to be. And Jesus says, not what I will, but what you will. And he came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray. Again, keep watch. Be on guard. Be a witness that you may not enter into temptation or trial here. That again, it's the trial or temptation. It's the same trial or temptation when we say in the Lord's Prayer, Lord, deliver us from a time of testing. Deliver us from temptation. It's not that God is tempting you. It's that the time of testing is the time when your quality is going to be shown. It's the time when you're plunged into the refiner's fire and all that is worthless and dross will be burned away and only the gold remains. I don't want that to happen to me. Deliver me from that. But if I should have to go through it, I hope that only gold remains. I hope there's gold there that will remain. Pray that you may not enter into temptation. You don't want to go into the time of testing, Peter, but you are about to. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. The spirit, this isn't a false dichotomy between spirit and body. It's similar to what Paul talks about in his letters. The idea here is not that you have a body and your spirit is somehow animating your dead flesh as if you are a captain of a ship and your soul is the captain sitting in the control room and your body is the ship moving through the world. It's more like you have a spirit body and a fleshly body. Your spirit body is the body that is in touch with the source of all life. This is your spiritual self. Your fleshly body is your body which is operating according to the kingdoms of man. Your spirit body operates in the kingdom of God, but that's still a body, and your fleshly body operates according to the kingdoms of man, and it's still a body. One body, but two animating spirits or animating energy. The spirit body wants to emerge and be with Jesus, the source of all life, but the flesh is trying to cling a hold to its former safety and security that comes from saying no to God. And again, Jesus went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found the disciples sleeping, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. Similar to up on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter does not know what he is saying. The disciples here are at the moments of Jesus's clearest or most overt times of communion with his true self, communion with the Father, revelation from God. The disciples do not know what to do. They do not know how to answer him. Again, little evidence here of the firsthand witnesses, Peter himself, puncturing his own celebrity bubble and showing his readers, I was not this great leader that you see today. I was a moron who didn't know what to say. And Jesus came a third time and said to them, are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Arise, let us go. See, my betrayer is at hand. The hour has come. Again, a motif that's quite important in the Gospels. It's very prominent in John, where Jesus more than once says, my hour is not yet here. And then finally he says, my hour is come. And again, it's the idea that Jesus is not a passive victim who is being enthralled by the different powers ranged against him, who has no control over it. This is Jesus constantly aware of what's going on around him. He's not taken by surprise. He's willingly laying down his life and then taking it up again. And he's aware of the hour and the times. He's not being surprised by anything, even though they are going to kill him. So the idea is submission to evil without fighting it, dominating it, giving in to the temptation to use evil's own power against itself. And immediately, there's Mark's word again, immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas comes. Here comes Judas, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. The crowd again is here, right? This is a different sort of crowd. It's the same word though, right? So in the Gospel of Mark, the crowd at any one time might be made up of different types of people. It might be made up of Jewish peasants, it might be made up of Gentile peasants, it might be made up of scribes and Pharisees. So the actual individual constitution of the crowd changes, but the crowd as a character remains. And the crowd is always present in some form or another around Jesus. And here the crowd has come with swords and clubs. In the Gospel of John and in Luke and Matthew, we get a little bit more information about these people. John tells us that Judas came to the Garden of Gethsemane with a cohort of Roman soldiers and temple guards. So a combination of Jewish peacekeeper soldiers and Roman soldiers. It is just worth mentioning that if you think that this is Jesus and 12 men being met by Judas and 12 men with clubs and swords, if you think it's just this is the scene, then you're not paying attention to some of the details that John and the others are telling us, which is that a cohort is 600 Roman soldiers, for example. These crowds, these mobs, are hundreds of people. This is a large amount of people. Somebody somewhere looked at Jesus and his followers camped out on the side of the mountain and said, we're going to need 600 soldiers to take him out. This is a rebellion. This is a movement that is about to take root. Jesus' claim to kingship was credible. And Jesus has 12 of his core followers around him, but there are far more than 12 people who are part of this Jesus movement. To meet a crowd of Jesus people camped out on the mountainside just outside of Jerusalem, you're going to need a crowd of people with swords and clubs. And this is the sort of assault on Jesus and his kingdom that the Gospels want you to know is happening. And the chief priests and the scribes and the elders are all there. And then Judas betrays him, and he says to the one I kiss is the man, seize him and lead him under guard. There's lots of people here. They don't know what Jesus necessarily looks like. There isn't an internet. There isn't wanted posters. There's just a huge mass of people, probably lots of little campfires in the forest on the side of the hill, and they don't know which one is Jesus. Which of these campfires is where Jesus is? And Judas says, I know where he is. Let me take you. The other aspect, which Mark doesn't go into, but it's quite poignant in the other Gospels, is that Judas is taking the soldiers to the garden where Jesus often was with his friends. Judas is taking the betrayal back into the heart of where the friendship happened. It was the place that he said, I know where he's going to be because we all used to hang out there. We liked this spot. Let me take you there. And it's a betrayal at the heart of the friendship that Jesus was cultivating with his disciples, whom he loved, we're told more than once. And the enemies now are coming out in force against Jesus. And he's betrayed by a kiss. And so then Jesus has hands laid upon him and seized. And one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And we're told in other Gospels that this was Peter. Peter strikes the servant, who again we're told is named Malchus in other Gospels. And his ear is cut off. And Jesus says to them, have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? The word robber is not just house thief. Remember, the word robber is laestes, which is road bandit or highwayman. And the laestes were not just petty thieves. They were seen as part of the freedom fighter movement. A laestes who robbed the Roman roads was an enemy of Rome and, in lots of ways, a champion of the people, like a Robin Hood character. He's robbing from the rich and sticking it to the man, and the poor like it. When Jesus is saying, what, am I a laestes? Am I a rebellious anti-Roman freedom fighter who's starting a rebellion? Who's coming out of Galilee with all his followers? Is that what you think I am? And there's a clear repudiation of violence here. It happens in the other Gospels too, where Jesus reprimands Peter and he heals Malchus. He heals the enemy by putting his ear back on. Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled. The scriptures are that we've already had this many times, haven't we? Where the father of the vineyard, the owner of the vineyard, says, I will send my son. I've sent all my prophets. They've been beaten and kicked out. But I will send my son, because surely they will listen to my son. And Jesus, in his parable of the vineyard, said, yes, but what's going to happen? They're actually going to kill the son and think, aha, now we have the inheritance. It will be ours. This is the idea that God's prophets are always killed when they try and speak truth into habits of life and structures that people think are sorted and settled. We're done. We're ready. We've got our priests. We've got our kings. We've got our laws. We've got our privilege and our prejudices. We're done. We know how to operate life now. And if anybody comes from the outside saying, you have forgotten the cause of the oppressed, you have forgotten the meaning of life, I say to you, well, then we're going to kill them. And the scriptures contain multiple evidence that that's what happens. Peoples of God kill prophets of God all the time. And everyone left him and fled. Verse 31, but Peter said emphatically, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And they all said the same. Verse 50, and they all left him and fled. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Verse 51, 52, mysterious little vignette here. It's never been very clear who this person is. There is, I think, a very credible suggestion that this is the author of the Gospel of Mark, who putting himself into the text, that he was maybe there as one of the disciples. Remember, there's more than 12. There were lots of disciples. The disciple was just the word used to describe followers of Jesus. And it could be that the young man was one of them. And now he's putting himself into this text. We honestly don't know. But that is certainly an argument that I've heard before. And again, it would be an example of Mark, or whoever the author's name really is of this gospel, of Mark nodding to his readers saying, look, you know who I am. You've heard me tell this story before. Let me puncture the celebrity bubble. Remember, I wasn't a hero. I would rather have been naked than be seen to be with Jesus, even though I had just said, I will never betray you. And they lead Jesus to the high priests, and all the chief priests and elders and the scribes came together. A lot of these groups of people hated each other, remember, but now they hate Jesus even more, so they're together in one place. And Peter follows at a distance, and he goes right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he's sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Again, notice the high level of personal detail here. It's another one of these hints that a lot of this material is coming to us from Peter. It seems that there's more than one source for these texts. The Gospel of Mark is coming from more than one place. But the Peter eyewitness testimony stuff is filled with details which are evocative of a real person, that the personality of Peter really comes out, which suggests to me and to some other scholars that this is where we are allowed to think of Peter as the eyewitness here. In any case, there's lots of the chief priests and the whole council are seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they couldn't find anything. Verse 56, for many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. It's worth noting here that this charge against Jesus, that he was against this is the charge that they're bringing against him. They're trying to make it stick. And it's like saying, we don't really understand what he was saying, but it has something to do with attacking the temple. And that's the charge that they're trying to make stick against Jesus. From the Jewish Pharisee point of view, Jesus's great offense is that he's against the temple. He's either physically wanting to destroy the temple, or he's standing in the courtyard and saying, this temple that you think is so important is actually all about me now. Whatever he's doing, which is mysterious and offensive, it seems to be anti-temple. So this is how we're going to kill him. But they could not actually find a way to agree. And then the high priest stands up in the midst and asks Jesus, well, have you no answer to make? Why don't you make it clear? He's basically asking Jesus, make this mess more clear. What is it that these men are testifying against you? They don't understand. But Jesus remained silent and made no answer. And again, the high priest asked him, are you the anointed one, the king, the son of the blessed? And Jesus said, I am. Oh, that's interesting. Messianic secret is gone. Yes, I am the Messiah. I am the Messiah at the moment when I've been arrested and bound. I have lies against me. I have the most powerful people in the land standing above me in judgment. I have people baying for my blood, and I am silently standing in this place of voluntary submission to you. Now I can tell you, I am the Messiah. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Daniel 7. Jesus is saying, at this moment, this person you see before you, this is me right now. Now you're seeing the great figure, the true human who's coming to take his position of authority over the nations. This is happening right now. You're seeing it. And of course, who can bear this teaching if you are a person of power? If you are one of the elite privilege whose whole vested interest and identity is in maintaining your position of power? Who could bear this teaching? And the high priest cannot do it. He tears his garment and said, what further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some of them began to spit on him and cover his face and to strike him, saying, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. So Jesus is beaten and handed over to the forces of violence that are baying for his blood. At the moment when he reveals his messiahship in a place of weakness. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the serving girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also with the Nazarene Jesus. But he denied it. And then the servant girl sees him again and begins to again say, this man is one of them, right? There's many people around Jesus, so she recognizes him. But how does she recognize it? He denies it. And after a little while, she says to Peter, certainly you're one of them, for you are a Galilean. And I've read some commentators here that saying, basically, she's recognized his accent. She's heard Peter speak, and she knows that he's a Galilean because of his accent. And the accent of Galilee was not a sophisticated accent. In fact, it was an accent that other people made fun of because it was seen as a country bumpkin yokel kind of. It wasn't sophisticated, and it wasn't one that commanded respect. It's worth noting that Jesus also was a Galilean. But anyway, Peter denies it. He begins to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. He calls down heaven to defend himself against his association with Jesus. Jesus has now been abandoned by the crowd. He's been abandoned by the chief priests and the rulers of the law who are meant to recognize the Messiah when they see it. He's been abandoned by his friends, the people he loves, and he's abandoned by his own disciples. And immediately the cock crows a second time. And Peter remembers, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. We will be continuing our study of Mark 15 in the next episode.